Blog Talk Radio.
Cosmic Citizen, and I'm assuming we have Phil. Phil, are you with us? Okay. Looks like we have a little problem with our audio. So I'm going to now welcome everybody. This happens with live broadcasting. We don't have Kevin. We don't have our guest Phil. Although I am showing Phil, I am showing a number. And may have to do a three-way with you, Phil. So what I'm going to do here is play a new song that Larry Watkins just put on the board. It's by our good buddy Lee, who's gone on to the heavens. It's Mansion Boogie, and it's a great song. I'm looking at the chat. Phil, I cannot hear you. It's interesting, your number is showing up as area code 000, so you must be coming through Skype. And if you would please, here we go. I'm going to play a song here, and it's just a fun song just to sort of get us warmed up here, get it going. Here we go.
Celestial artisans. There's much to learn
You there?
Plenty of time to get there.
Okay, just a second.
You need to know as you were seeing.
Just a second.
Don't be afraid. Just be yourself. You can be at peace with your trusted seraphim. Just spread your wings and mansion boogie.
Good morning, everyone, again. And Phil, are you with me?
I hear you. Do you hear me?
Yes, we do hear you, and we're going to do a sound check. And I'm not sure why Kevin is not here yet.
Yeah, and I tried Skype, but I couldn't get – I heard you fine, but I couldn't seem to hear – you couldn't hear me, and I don't know why.
Right, and Kevin comes through Skype, so I don't know what's going on right there. Of course, anytime you're dealing with Skype and going through the computer, you know how that goes. Well, good morning, Phil.
Well, good morning.
And I guess it's a little early there for you. You're in San Diego.
Right. Yeah, I was up early today.
Well, you know,
I tried to get on earlier at to the. I kept getting bounced off of the phone number, and then finally got into the chat there about 10 minutes. Were you on the chat all that hour?
Right. Yeah, I saw you sign in. I'm assuming that was you.
Yeah, Cosmo 606.
Yes. Well, while we're waiting on Kevin, I've been reading. Of course, we've known each other for a long, long time, Philip. Phil, I have to call you
Phil. Yeah, Phil's fine.
Phil. And the way I wrote about you on Facebook, I love Facebook. It's really a marvelous way to stay connected. I remember meeting you consciously for the first time at a scientific symposium in Oklahoma City. And I don't recall what year that was, Phil. I know you spoke about the speed of transport seraphim, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm. Yeah. Well, it would have been, let's see.
88, 92?
Something in that neighborhood.
And I remarked in my Facebook account, on the Facebook, that I glanced over, you and I were sitting on the back row, and I just had the deepest sense that I was about to hear revelation of revelation, and that's what manifested. And I'm going to do a brief intro of you. Of course, people can look at Cosmic Citizen, your bio on there. Is
yeah,
quite
I noticed that.
Quite extensive. And I'll just read it here, and we are praying that young Kevin get connected. He does have other alternatives. He can call through his cell phone if he needs to instead
yeah.
of Skype.
Yeah, I was about to try that myself. It's too bad this...
Well, it's okay. That's live broadcasting. We just deal with it.
Yeah.
Well,
let's see.
Well, I'll go ahead and introduce you here, okay?
Sure.
Phil Calabrese, Dr. Philip Calabrese. Phil, you're an internationally recognized mathematician. Boy, that's an understatement. And you're credited with combining deductive logic and conditional probability in a common context. My. Something impossible within the standard logic of Boolean. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Algebra?
Boolean.
Boolean?
No.
Boolean.
George Boole.
My southern accent, Phil. You'll have to forgive me. And you know, as I was reading about that, and I always loved algebra, calculus, I didn't get to pursue that in the way I desired. And you're going to have to explain that in mere mortal terms, okay? Because it's quite a quantum leap you did there is what I understand.
Well,
and
basically...
Go ahead, yes.
The idea was to be able to do conditional logic where your conclusions are relatively absolute, unless you've made a mistake, or where, you know, if I say a number is less than 3, then it certainly is less than 4.
Right.
But if I say, you know, I roll a die and the number was less than 4, well, it might also have been less than 3, but that's not certain.
Mm.
That is a good bet because you have 2 chances out of 3. If it's going to be less than 4, it'll be less than 3 2 out of 3 times if you're rolling a die. So you like to have statements that are absolutely true, and you like to have statements that are probable. And how do you combine the two in such a way that you don't distort the information? And that was has been a big problem in expert systems and in all various ways of combining information. And what I did was expanded the events or the propositions into fractions or pairs,
uh-huh.
just like we do for numbers in order to get more precision in our arithmetic or, you know, in order to represent parts of a pie or parts of things, we need fractions. And if we tried to do it all with integers, it would be very cumbersome. Although it's possible every time you use fractions, it does reduce to arithmetic with integers. But we've learned that using fractions, we can represent distances and amounts much more conveniently. And then when we multiply and divide or add or subtract, we have rules for how to do that with fractions. Well, what I did was I represented information, conditional information, as a fraction in which the denominator was the premise.
Okay.
And the numerator was whatever I was identifying, whatever proposition or event I was identifying in the context of that premise, given that premise. And so the information really always carries two events or two propositions, whatever you're assuming, and then whatever it is you're identifying under those assumptions. So, you know, if I say I'm going to roll a die, a single die that has six faces, and I say the roll is going to be an even roll, 2, 4, or 6. Well, the probability of that is a half, if it's a fair die. And so I represent that statement with, you know, given that it's, I might say given that it's an even roll, what about 2 or 4 coming up? So here you have, given that it's an even roll, 2 or 4 is another subset, which is a part of the 2, 4, or 6 that would be the event of getting an even roll. So given you get an even roll, what's the probability that you get a 2 or a 4? Well, it's 2/3. So I represent the information, however, with a pair of events, either even, well, the one event, the denominator would be 2, 4, or 6, that event, and then the numerator would be 2, 4, that event. And so I end up with pairs of events, and then I was able to come up with operations for intersection and union and complement, you know, not, and, or, and not, and also even iterated conditionals. You know, if I say, if whenever I walk across a street, I look both ways, then I won't be, you know, hit by a car. So you have these compound conditionals, and they were, you know, this is like when you take two fractions and you divide one by the other. So all of that was able to be done using these fractions, and I was able to represent the conditional information as well as for both logic as well as conditional probability in a common context that didn't drop information on the floor or distort it.
Mm-hmm.
So
I want to know, do you go to Vegas often, Phil?
No, I never never tried that. Actually, a fellow mathematician by the name of Thorpe did a lot of that in Las Vegas and made a lot of money before they caught on to him. But he was playing craps. He was shooting dice. So... but, you know, the military, when I worked for the Navy, they certainly used this information. And
well, that was my next question, because
yeah.
As I'm reading your bio here, you made some very interesting decisions, Phil, in your personal life.
Interesting is a gracious way to put it, probably.
And I'm like, okay. I'll read this one paragraph. After President Kennedy was assassinated, you dropped your math courses at Harvard? Wow. Instead, you went for a 3-year NASA, which in Illinois. So that's fascinating, the Institute of Technology. And that's where you graduated. Now, you were on a full scholarship at Harvard.
Actually, I didn't put all the details there. I had a what they called an alternate fellowship, which, and I had turned down UC Berkeley, which had an actual full-time fellowship, because when I was making my decision, my mother and father, my mother said, well, we've heard of Harvard, but where's this Berkeley place? So had I gone there, I probably would have been taught by the Unabomber. because he was there about the time when I would have been a graduate student
in the 60s.
So I went to Harvard and decided to go there instead, and then the alternate fellowship didn't actually come through, so I was looking for looking like I would have to pay for that. And then I had a girlfriend back in Chicago that I had just left. And then when Kennedy was assassinated, I don't know, it seemed... And then, of course, then I was able to line up 3 years of support. And back in those days, it didn't seem like a bad idea to come back to Chicago and take that NASA traineeship for something like $3,200 a year, which was a lot of money for a graduate student in those days.
Wow.
The National Foundation was only giving 1 year for $2,400, and this was $3,200 a year for 3 years. So I guess I went for the money and also the girl, and thought, well, Harvard doesn't really want me, since they decided to... I guess anybody who was struck down by lightning on their way to accept their offer, then they might have had someone move up in the alternate list. But it wasn't, I didn't get it, so...
Well, I don't think it was meant to be, Phil, the way you've ended up. I just really believe that this is, and with you moving back and the relationship, there's all, that's all a good reason for doing that. It all works out.
I guess so. You know, it would have been handy to have a Harvard degree as things got harder in the 70s. Well, you know, you make your decisions and then you live with them.
Yes, you do. And it looks like you've lived with it in a mighty fine way, Phil.
Well, I survived.
and you've... You've applied this. Let's get back to the Navy. And then we'll move on to how you applied this knowledge through your spiritual experience with the Urantia book, which I really enjoyed reading. But how has the Navy practically applied this in their technology?
Well, an example would be in the case of two surveillance radars, which overlap in their domain of of surveillance, and they each have a certain probability of detecting, let's say, an object in the in their area, their surveillance area. So now, if an object or an airplane or something is going by, and you might say, well, if it's in the surveillance area of the first radar, there's a certain probability that it'll be detected. And if it's in the surveillance regions of the second, then there's similarly a probability that it'll be detected. So now, what's the probability that it would be detected by one or both?
Mm.
At least one.
Mm.
And of course, it depends on where it is. If it's in both surveillance areas, then of course you have a chance for that. If it's just in one, then the other one can't see it. So how do you combine that information to come up with an overall probability of detection? That would be an example of the kind of problem that would be approachable using my logic of conditional events or Boolean fractions.
I see Larry Watkins is writing in the chat, Phil. Are you looking at the chat room? He says, let's detect a UFO.
I haven't been looking at that, but I could.
That's okay. It's tough. I have one, two, let's see, how many windows? This is interesting, Phil. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven windows are open on my computer right now. So that gets pretty dynamic.
Oh, yeah.
So but anyway, Larry has a wonderful sense of humor. He keeps us on track. And I'm waiting here because they're wanting to know how this tied in with you discovering the Urantia book. And so we'll move toward that. But go ahead and finish your thought here, please.
Well, I thought I was finished.
Okay.
I don't remember what it was I was saying.
Well, you were talking about how the Navy has applied it
in very
practical terms.
You know, I think that they have applied it in ways that they haven't necessarily informed me about, too, since I didn't have the highest security clearance, partly because I wanted to be able to publish in the open literature. So, I'm sure that they, I remember getting a phone call from the Naval Postgraduate School where one of the mathematicians there was designing an operating system, and he had some questions because he was incorporating my algebra in it. So they used it in different ways to represent this kind of information in a way that they couldn't do it before. So it would be difficult to give more specifics, but I could give you examples in general of how the information is combined using these fractions. But I think it would probably not be worth trying to get any further into that.
Well, let's talk about how you discovered. You had a spiritual experience.
Yes.
Now, did that coincide with you discovering the Urantia book? And you as a scientist, you know, that has to really line up in a different way. I've often said that you come to the Urantia book, you come to understand it through the window of faith or just incredible sheer knowledge that you bring to the table. And in the beginning, I will tell you, I'm blessed. I have a decent mind, and I am very blessed. But I know that when I first started reading the book, I had to have some help there. I had to just walk in faith until it. And listening to you talk, Phil, reminds me of one time I was sitting about to introduce the book at a Whole Life Expo. And Dwayne Falk stood up and read a paragraph from the Urantia book. General, you know, of course, you knew Dwayne.
Sure.
Brigadier General, our precious brother, who's gone on to the Mansion Worlds. And until that moment, when he read that, I had not comprehended it, Phil. But when he read it, I got it. Now, I can't say that I could have stood up and explained that paragraph in that moment, but later on I did. There's a consciousness that comes in when we come together, and that is just incredible. And that spiritual experience you had, would you share that with us?
Okay. I think I can answer all those questions that you raised by, telling you how it went. I was raised Roman Catholic and practiced Roman Catholicism pretty religiously until I was about 23. In fact, when I was in college, the dormitory guys used to call me the Pope because I was always the apologist for the Catholic's position. Not that I always believed everything completely, but I knew it well enough, having gone through 12 years of parochial school and being taught by the Dominican priests in high school. We studied the Summa Theologica by Aquinas.
Wonderful order, wonderful order.
So that I was, steeped in all this Catholicism, and of course I met people in the dormitory who were less than enthusiastic about Roman Catholicism. So it was a time for me to try out my understanding. And After about a year or two of this, I had a conversation with a Greek friend, student friend of mine, and he pointed out that the principle of infallibility couldn't be correct.
Say that again, Phil.
The principle of infallibility, of papal infallibility.
Infallibility.
When speaking ex cathedra in matters of faith and morals, they qualify it in that way. But he pointed out that nothing could be that certain.
Right.
And and after I argued with him about it, I became convinced that there was a problem. There really was a problem there. And as I thought about it, and as I realized that they had that I was feeling a lot of guilt for the kind of things that I was experiencing with my girlfriend, that I needed to put this whole thing aside. I needed to put this whole question aside because I wasn't able to think objectively about it anymore. I realized that, but I just put Roman Catholicism aside, although I never stopped believing in God. So I continued on that way until I was married, and about a year after that, I realized, well, I don't have any moral conflicts, and I don't have, you know, and I graduated with, a year before or two, in 68, and this was in about 69. So I thought, you know, it would be nice to settle this issue that I've put aside, figure out whether there's a kernel of truth in there somewhere. So I decided to approach it like a scientist and thought, well, how would I proceed? And I asked myself, what is my connection to God? Is it the Catholic Church? Is it the Bible? Is my connection somehow religious tradition? What is my connection to God? So I had that question in mind because is it the Pope? Because he's the fellow who has authority to make the rules and I'm supposed to follow them. What's my connection? So with that question in mind, I said, well, how shall I proceed? And I thought, well, I should read people who are, you know, experts and have thought about these questions. Immediately thought, well, I ought to start with Jesus, not as a divine creature or being, but rather just as an individual who obviously was a religious leader. So let me hear what he has to say. So I started reading the New Testament, disregarding everything that anybody other than Jesus was saying, and just the red letters, so to speak. And I went through, read and think about this for half an hour, 45 minutes at a time. And I spent, different times of the day. It might be whenever it occurred to me. I'd spend a little time reading Matthew and pondering it rather carefully, word for word, like I would, you know, a mathematical topic. And so as I went through, a few days, weeks went by, and I was going through slowly Matthew, Mark, and I realized early on that Jesus is saying, oh, the kingdom of God is like this, and the kingdom of God is like that. the kingdom of God. I said, if I could just figure out what he's talking about when he says the kingdom of God, I'll know what Jesus has to say about this. So I'm reading into, at this point I'm into Luke. It's probably 2 or 3 months since I started. And I come to the quote that the scribes and the Pharisees came to Jesus and said, when is this kingdom you talk about going to come? You know, how will we know? And he says, well, it's not going to come with fanfare. It's not going to come if they say, lo, here it is, lo, it is, or there, look, you know, don't go. Because the kingdom of God is in the midst of you. Well, the footnote in the Revised Standard for that quote says some translations have within you. The kingdom of God is within you. Well, when I read that, it finally dawned on me that my connection to God would have to be like a theorem. It would have to be something that came out of my own mind because nothing else would be acceptable. A magician could do something, and I would not be willing to say, well, therefore God exists. It would have to be something that would approach me from within my own mind. Anything external, well, it could be somebody's trick. So what happened next was complete surprise because I had this insight, and then I'm alone in my bedroom, or actually a little room off of the bedroom up there in Monterey, California, and I feel as though all of a sudden I'm sitting there with my back to the room mostly, and reading this Bible, and I feel as though I'm no longer in the room alone. And it's so intense that I literally turn around to take a look around to see, and at that point I realize there's a reaction, some kind of a spiritual reaction, as though there's a being there, and this being is a little amused at my reaction. So I realize that there's another presence in the room, and I'm feeling very loved. It's still a moment
that was just
talk.
A real spiritual awakening.
So I realized what was happening, and sort of got my senses back a little bit. I mean, I was shocked by what was happening, and I realized, kept going. And I, you know, I'm feeling this way, and I realized that this is the answer to my question. So I'm thinking, well, I'm going to study the relationship between science and spirit or matter and spirit. Anyway, my mind sort of wanders. And when I come back to the moment, this presence is still there. I'm still experiencing this, and that scares me a little bit. And I think to myself or say, how long am I going to be this way? And back comes the answer, just as long as you require it. So I continued basking in this experience for at least 5 or 10 more minutes until there was absolutely no doubt in my mind. And then I said, okay, I guess I can go back to practicing how I used to be, something like that. And within 10, 15 seconds, I felt this spirit presence get closer, somehow coalesce until I could no longer distinguish it from my own consciousness. I mean, I couldn't, it was no longer external or somehow in the room apart from my own presence. So that experience, I didn't tell anybody about it for quite a while, years. But I started talking about, you know, truth and beauty and goodness and stuff like that, justice. And as part of a conversation, this experience happened in December, around July, August. I was at a friend's house, I think in San Francisco, and talking about some of this stuff, and he said, you know, that sounds a little bit like what a hitchhiker was telling me about. This book sounds like Tarantula. Well, his brother, this was Pat Hunt, his brother Bob Hunt is there, and he said he had that in mind and found this book at the Metaphysical Bookstore in Berkeley. And he said, you know, I thought of you, Phil, when I saw that little halo went over my head and I decided to buy this book. So he bought the book, and after a week or two, he showed it to me, and it was love at first sight. I picked up the book. It was summertime, so I had time, and started reading it. After a couple of weeks, he wanted his copy back, and I sent for another copy in Chicago, and started reading it pretty much avidly every day, and finished it in about four and a half months.
Did you say 4 months?
Yeah, about 4 months. I had the Concordix at the same time,
mm-hmm.
and the first thing I did was read about various topics that I felt I knew something about and was interested in hearing what this book had to say.
Let's mention
the
Concordix. Now, a lot of people may not know what the Concordix is.
Like an index.
Yeah, Clyde Bedell's.
Yeah.
I'm sure people can find that on the websites, Truthbook, urantiabook.org, urantia.org. I'm sure it's there.
Yes, and it's not a very expensive book, if I recall. It kept it down. But it's a good index, and so I looked up, you know, everywhere in there that they mention time or space or spirit or matter or various other things that were of interest to me, and I realized that, boy, this is good stuff. And then I decided I'd read the last part of the book on Jesus, and then when I finished that part, I went back to the beginning and read the whole thing again. And so...
Now, how long did that... So that entire circuit...
Yeah, all of that process took about the same amount of time, about four and a half months. I got it in August, and
That's amazing.
By November.
Well, I can already tell, Phil, you're going to have to come back on the broadcast with us because there's just so much to talk about with your latest book in progress. And one thing we do that you don't know, we have a poetic interlude, and
mm-hmm.
and Suzanne Kelly is now on the air with us.
Oh, okay.
And
yes,
she
was listening last Saturday, I guess, or Saturday before last.
And Suzanne, you have some poetry you're going to cite from Ilan Vital, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
There she is.
I'm here.
What page number are you reading from?
Well, you know, I figured since Phil was here, I'd go through a little bit of the science that I have in here.
You've definitely had your own spiritual experiences. I'm sure you just heard what Phil was talking
about. Yeah, I can relate.
Yeah, and when a scientist talks like that, Phil, that is just incredible because you bring to the table such unique viewpoint. And that's what I love about your Ranch Boat Readers. We just come from all these various backgrounds, and it just works. It just works. Okay, Suzanne, where are you citing?
Well, okay, I'm going to recite from page 23, and it goes into the divisions of matter. The science will eventually understand the 10 divisions of matter Even in division, separation will blend to form the expanse of the latter. Ultimatonic, electron's mother. Subelectronic, solar supergas's brother. Electronic matter, material differentiation, precedes subatomic of our sun's affirmation. Shattered atoms, cooling suns in space, are followed by ionized matter X-ray. Atomic matter in a chemical stage paves the way of the stable molecular phase. Radioactive spawns matter disorganized, and at last is collapsed as a great sun dies. So light, heat, electricity, magnetism, chemism, energy, they form the basis of past, present, future, as the core of existential aperture. And try as we will in science's depths, we will never dissect the life in God's breath, for the salient magnitude of God's creative force far surpasses man's ability of source. Imagination cannot even grasp the grandeur of exaction and the perfection of both action and might to the tiniest fraction. For if massive matter magnifies an electron to 1/10 of an ounce, the volume thus intensified would hold the earth in its house. And if its heavier proton fit the head of a pin, its circumference would encompass earth's orbital spin. So minuscule man must accept the omnipotence of source and understand he is but one tiny speck in the multitudinous energy force. For as atoms contain electrons of 100, they segregate as they spin. In the center are 30 observed as one, then 30 more their next of kin. 30 others form the third energy zone held in a definite orbit. 10 remain as a dignified lot, and Mother Nucleus allows them to exit. And as atoms proceed, the first 27 we are able to comprehend. But in 26 more, predictability wanes, and the unqualified absolute extends. For atoms are likened to persons, predictability in groups. But statistics tend to lose their grip when one is on the loose.
Wow, Phil, what do you think?
Well, that's very poetic.
Thank you. Definitely poetic.
Yes. And, Phil?
And I recognize a lot of the Urantiwook in there.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Phil, getting back to your new book, let's talk about your book, as we only have about 10 minutes left, 11 minutes. And speaking of, I know you bring such a whole brain of to the table because you're a classical pianist, you're a singer, and therefore you're a poet. I've never met a singer or a pianist that's not a poet. And mathematics is the highest form of music. And so I really am thankful for that in you. So what's the name of your new book?
Well, my working title is Science and Religion, Reason and Faith, A Mathematician Looks at the Issues. Because we have an awful lot of people out there nowadays, and in past days, people like Carl Sagan, who I enjoyed very much as a physicist, but whenever he would leave the physics and start the philosophy, by saying, well, purely by chance, such and such occurred, or such and such emerged. I read an awful lot of other things by people, scientists, who are poo-pooing the whole notion of religion, making it out as though there's the idea of spiritual reality is unnecessary. Areas such as freedom of choice or any degree of choice is inconsistent with the material, completely material sense of things, because That would mean that you could change the future.
Hmm.
And where is that energy going to come from? And so ultimately we need to form our basis using mind and spirit mind as a foundation for reality. And things like choice, which we all experience, even the scientists who deny it, needs to be incorporated into the cosmology. The individual persons who observe and make up and create, you know, stories or models of reality, who conceive of reality, they have to be part of the picture of the of reality. You can't, right now, the tendency is to eliminate the minds of the scientists who are conceiving the universe from the conception. But any concept of the universe is a concept that is held by some mind. So the mind has to be part of the concept of reality. You cannot do away with it. So we need mind, and we need spirit, we need matter, and we need personality, because we have this choice. We have these choices. We can transcend time and space even with this, with these persons that we are. So I feel the need to synthesize a cosmology that is, and write about it, that is appropriate for our time. We now have this Urantia book, which gives us a great deal of cosmic information by which we can appreciate the spiritual message all the better. And I feel the need to express a cosmology that would give adequate weight to the matter without neglecting the mind and the spirit, to put these into a unified whole with the advantage of the Urantia book. I feel as though I should do this because there are plenty of voices out there claiming that it's all nonsense. I mean, nowadays we have cognitive scientists who are saying that, well, there's no such thing as free will. It's just like a whistle on a train. It makes a lot of noise but doesn't amount to anything.
Hmm.
So I feel a need to push back a little bit on them and affirm that there is something more, as William James said, than the matter.
You know, as Phil, I don't know if I can interject here, when I was reading my little blurb there, I stopped just short of that inclusion. And if you'll allow me, I will throw that in right here. It says, in all these embroiling forces, we find the separate consummation of indecipherable mind. For mind, in its ability to conceive, creates, designs, sends, and receives. In universal mechanism, mind abounds, and its total observation is held in scope by the ability and capacity of investigation. The evolution of mechanisms indicates and implies concealed presence, dominance of creative mind. And as mortal intellect devises and creates, man's intelligence progresses to spiritual states. For spirit is the architect, the builder of the mind, the body, the edifice where these two reside. And spirit awakens imaginative reality, reflecting parts of time, space, totality. For in mortal man, his mind is the key of free will submission to a spiritual lead. And spirit, acquiesces to whence it came. In choice, personality ascends to its infinite name.
Very nice.
Thank you. That combines both of them.
Well, Phil, when can we expect your book to be on the market?
Well, I have to finish it. I'm about halfway through, maybe. I'm going to include a statistical analysis of some of the scientific, prophetic science in the Urantia book.
Yes, I really enjoyed reading. And people can find your articles on the, I know.
Some of them are on the fellowship website.
Right, and Suzanne, didn't y'all publish some in your publication?
In the journal?
Yes.
Phil, have we done any of yours in the IUA journal?
I'm not sure. I know that there's been some in IUA publications.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But I'm not sure if I'm in the journal.
Well, I'd love to get some of your
arena.
Pardon?
I was in the arena.
In the arena, okay.
For Australian New of the IUA.
Right, right. Well, I am the editor. I would love to publish some of your work. So if you'd have something you'd like to send me, I'd love to put it in there.
All right, I'll keep that in mind.
All right.
Well, we're down to the four-minute mark. Phil, I wish we had some of your music to play. You need to.
I don't know. I think my I'm pretty much an amateur when it comes to playing the piano. Although I've done it all my life, I don't practice enough, and so I tend to play for my own enjoyment and maybe a few other people. But if I get nervous, then the whole thing falls apart. So.
Oh, we never get nervous, right, Suzanne? Oh, no, no, no.
Oh, no, no.
Well, you've been blessed. Y'all had Pato there with you, I know, around the holiday season, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's now in Colorado. And a lot of times we end the broadcast with Pato singing, and we need to upload some new songs. But I hate to ask too much of Larry Watkins. I'm always emailing him, can we do this, can we do that? And he does so much in the background. And Suzanne, you didn't get to hear it, but we played a real East Texas cowboy song by Lee Farmer, Mansion Boogie.
I love that, yeah.
Yeah, and we are so thankful and so grateful that we have permission to play his music.
Yes.
And he's in the mansion world now.
Yes, he
doing
is.
The mansion boogie. So yes, thank you, Phil. And we did have some technical things going on, but you know, I totally trust that it's all for a reason. Will you come back and join us again, please?
Sure.
Oh, that'd be wonderful. Look forward to seeing you in person. You know, we'll be out there, Steve and I, because you know we have our daughter that lives there, our older daughter, in Venice, and love to come out there. So
in
we'll
San Diego.
She lives in Venice up there.
Oh yeah.
Uh huh.
A little bit.
Yeah, that's not
North
bad man. Drive. And we love to go out there on your side of the country this time of the year. We're not going to Baltimore or even Virginia Beach right now.
Yeah, well, it's partly cloudy today, a little brisk, but, you know, it's nice for...
Well, you are in God's country in San Diego. My, 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 my. Mm.
Oh, yeah, that's beautiful.
Well, let's hear from our dear buddy, Pato, A New Day Dawning.
All right.
Okay, God bless. Thanks,
bless
Suzanne.
You.
We
Thank
love
you.
You, Kevin. We love you, Kevin. Get that new computer. Bye, y'all.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Yes, I believe. and I can hear the angels calling. Oh yes, it is a new day dawning. It's gotta be universal love. Oh yes, there is.